content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we are now reading from the chapter on youth, which is for May and June. And the topic, reading right now is Making Mosaics, Underplanting. It is easier to bring home several flats of some extra sturdy ground-covering perennial, plug it under trees and shrubs, and check that bed off the list. Done. In fact, in the outermost beds, to serve as living mulch and reduce weeding chores under big groups of woody plants, that's what I did with Geranium macrorhizium and some other strong but not invasive souls. Near the house where I come and go, as do visitors, that would be boring, no fun at all, for a she's gotta have it gardener. In high-profile areas, I make mosaics, not masses, layered, intermingling compositions aimed at visual interest over the longest possible season. They are a bit more work to tend than sheets of the stalwart geranium, but worth it. Here's how to do it. No ring around the rosy, thanks anyway. Rather than circling the drip line of trees or shrubs or a group of trees and shrubs with ground covers and bulbs and such, you have to get all the way in there, even nearly right up against the trunk, to make it look unman-made, as if it just happened. No polka dots except at first. It's all about learning to think mosaic, which doesn't mean polka dots of onesies, but sweeps and drifts and deliberate repetition of said sweeps and drifts. At first, though, no matter how many plants you buy or what you feed them, the new underplantings will look like polka dots, which leads to the next lesson. Patience is required. This gardening nonsense is all about patience. Frankly, I think it's a patience-building practice more than anything else. Your bed will look better next year and almost great 3 years after planting. After the fourth, you can start harvesting divisions to repeat your success elsewhere. Notice I say divisions, as in small pieces of plants. When working in the root zone of trees and even establishing shrubs, I work with a small trowel or a hori-hori and plant very small things. I use divisions made from older plants or order liners from my local nursery. The baby plants they get wholesale in late winter, then normally pot up and grow on to sell. I ask them to order me a tray of liners and mark it up accordingly, but to skip the repotting and growing on. No digging with a shovel or tiller, heaven forbid, in root zones. Again, patience is required, and a gentle hand, too. Select a palette that relies on several key plants with another or a couple as punctuation. Little gems to pop up from the carpet. Buy or divide So you have lots of men of each mainstay to get started. The late spring to fall palette under my oldest magnolia is glossy European ginger. Heconicloa macra, all gold. A very choice Japanese painted fern, and turquoise and gold hosta June, and all a native idea. At the must-visit native plant research facility and garden in Delaware called Mount Cuba Center, creeping phlox, maidenhair fern, foam flower, and Pennsylvania sedge intermingle as a long-lasting and winning combination. Include ephemerals, whether early spring bulbs or perennials, that rise and take advantage of the sunshine before the canopy leafs out, then vanish underground, or at least don't take up much space. Winter aconites, trilliums, Dutchman's breeches, bloodroot, twin leaf, Virginia bluebells, the list goes on. I get about 6 extra early weeks of color from my underplantings before my mainstay plants fill in, by using ephemerals lavishly. Include some ground cover types, meaning plants that form thick mats, but not English ivy or pachysandra or vinca. For this part of the plan, I am partial to epimediums, European ginger, Heconicloa, cloa, and hellebores. Make space for some real gems. These might include species peonies, choice hostas, I love gold ones for this purpose, or even bulbs like an effusion of martagon lilies, such as red-flowered clawed shride. What about an unexpected outburst from the bodiest of primroses, Primula chisona, with orchid pink flowers and lovely scalloped fuzzy foliage? When choosing plants, remember that leaves are your best friend. Plant on a mix of textures and colors, coming mostly from foliage, as the leaves will be there all season or even all year, the flowers just briefly. Think of the color range of heucheras alone you could employ, or hostas. Foliage is hardly boring, which relates to this lesson. Texture is also a great ally. Work it. I cannot imagine mosaics working without some linear things, grasses or sedges, contrasted against some ferny things, like, well, ferns or Aruncus aethufolius, and against some larger textured things, like bigger hostas, estilaboids, tabularis, or the northwest native Darmira peltata, which also offers extra early pink flowers on naked stems. Speaking of large and textured, the astilboids, cousins in the genus Rogersia, are among my most prized shade ground cover. Once you've selected a palette, repeat. not just in the first area you underplant, but if it works in another area, where it may be all mulch right now, or a sea of a single ground cover. Soon your first mosaic will fill in and afford you divisions, and you will move on to making the next beautiful carpet. And our next topic is Confidence Builders Rethought. And every gardener deserves a boost in confidence when new to horticulture. Inspired by this, many years ago, I recommended a list of certified confidence builders as starter plants. They were the ones that had given me early encouragement, a mismatched lot with vigor, their only common trait. They delivered the positive reinforcement required to stick at a hobby or as demanding as this. Things would have likely taken a different turn had I begun with delphiniums and alpines. They're pretty quickly proved a caveat. You will spend the advanced beginner phase of your gardening lifetime digging these plants out. With some, that means they are invasive thugs and need to be struck from not just the bed you put them in, but also from the list of things for sale anywhere ever, though most remain in catalogs and on nursery racks. With others, they are just lusty enough to provide a good lesson in the vigilant management of mixed plantings, or why some otherwise worthy choices, like mint, are best grown alone or in containers. Impressively, Bee Balm Monarda, a mint family member, still tops my certified confidence builder list. Adapting to sun or half shade and growing about a mile sideways a year, it does what its name implies and draws the bees and also hummingbirds. It had a prominent place, blooming for weeks in July until it just crept into everything else and also got powdery mildew, not great in a conspicuous spot. Now I recommend those needing confidence or one of the best pollinator plants first to do homework on which bee balms have a little more restraint and a little less mildew, and cite them carefully. Chicago Botanic Garden in Illinois and Mount Cuba Center in Delaware have each published research on mildew-resistant Monarda that can be found online, for example. Some of the ground cover sedums, like Sedum spurium or S. canticum and Sunny S. rupester Angelina, make me feel like I have a green thumb, but are easy to dispatch when the time comes. In contrast, a couple of Lysimachia that cheered me onward at the start will be with me till I die and beyond. The gooseneck loosestrife and the widespread U.S. native fringed loosestrife. I have the purple-leafed form called purpurea or firecracker. Neither is related to the dreaded pest of wetlands called purple loosestrife. Today, I think it's safer to get your boost from a literal jack-in-the-beanstalk plant like pole beans, including Scarlet Runner, another hummingbird favorite, and edible both as tender pods and later as dried beans. As I look out the window, I am reminded of many more shot-in-the-arm types, innocent looking like nursery pots of a juga or a bugleweed that I brought home, and bigger ones of the giant of ground covers, Petasites hybridus. I am still digging bugleweed out of the lawn decades later, but I do like its defiant blue flower wands. Fuki, as Petasites is called in Japan, has umbrella-sized tropical-looking leaves and spreads like crazy, particularly in moist and partly shaded areas. When I was a beginner gardener, I was proud of its performance, and even now I'd be sorry to live without it, and will never have to. Like any aggressive plant, it must be managed by the gardener, not allowed to wander from the space assigned. Remember who carries the shovel in the family. A hint, not the plant. And trench around your spreaders every year to keep them in their place, tossing the uprooted bits in the trash, not the compost. Better yet, with the lustiest like Fuki, don't get started. It is one plant I will never share with anyone, knowing now its formidable energy. And our next topic is a must-have rose. Roses are notably scarce here, but there is one I actually have in multiple. It's Rosa glauca, the blue-leafed rose, and that's why I grow it, for its beautiful foliage. I first came to know Rosa glauca by its former name, Rosa rubrifolia, meaning red-leaved because they're tinged with red, as are the stems. Whatever the name, it has arching canes that may get to about 6 or 8 feet tall, forming a roughly vase-shaped shrub, and is hardy to a brutal zone too, where I never wish to test it. The foliage color will be best in light shade, emphasis on light. Excuse me. But don't ask this or any rose to live in the dark, or fungal problems will prevail. In early June here, a bonus of small, single, vivid pink flowers appears, followed by good-sized orangey rose hips. My oldest Rosa glauca is underplanted with big root geranium, Geranium macrorrhizum, whose hot pink flowers coordinate nicely with the roses, and with lots of nectar roscordum siculum, or an allium cousin. Whose mauve blue-green blooms complete the picture, poking up from that. The rose's blue leaves make a distinctive addition to a mixed shrub border, especially vivid in contrast to purple-leaved plants. Because Rosa glauca is a species, a non-hybrid rose, it will self-sow around after setting hips, and the babies are true to form. Not a bad thing if you happen to want more and have patience. When my old one got out of shape, I cut back the rose to near the ground and started afresh. I confess, occasionally I pass a planting of some non-stop blooming modern rose series and have a pang of longing. For now, though, it's still just me and my Rosa glauca and an old suckering R. rugosa. I love its attractive orange hips. Plus, one super hardy pink climber, William Baffin, from the Canadian Explorer series, who's been cut to the ground a time or two himself in our decades together. And our next topic is a water garden in a pot. Mosquitoes. That's the most common question I'm asked when people see my seasonal water gardens in two ceramic troughs. What about mosquitoes? After that, how often do you change the water? Make an instant seasonal water garden, one with no plumbing required, merely requires a watertight vessel, water, and some floating plants to shade the surface. I top up the water as needed during the season, but do not change it completely, nor do I in the in-ground water gardens. For containers, you can use galvanized cattle tanks or tubs, earthenware pots with glazing, at least on their interior surface, like my big troughs, and no drainage hole or some other found object. Level the pot with a carpenter's level while still empty, inserting shims beneath as needed to adjust and stabilize. I prefer to place these temporary water gardens in a parched sun spot rather than full sun to reduce algae growth. The shade provided by floating plants like azolla, fairy moss, or lemna, duckweed, helps too. You can add fish, but I don't, since fish in a barrel are easy prey for cats or raccoons. The frogs add themselves at my place. Frogs, or fish, eat mosquito larvae, and mosquitoes, as do dragonflies and birds, who also crave the water, so I have no mosquito issue. One funny note, if the pot is topped up to near the rim, heavy rains will cause overflow, not just of water, but also of floating plants. So don't overfill, or when downpours are forecast, cover the pot most of the way. I leave an opening in case any frogs are in residence. In my cold winter zone, the seasonal water gardens must be emptied and the vessels stored in a shed for winter. I happily check for tadpoles before I do the emptying, lest any inhabitants have used them as a nursery. And our next topic is organic lawn care. Your lawn looks so great, visitors say, and I think, what lawn? They don't realize that I'm actually mowing a mix of turf grass and weeds, to which I have added loads of white clover that bees love and stays green in the heat. No herbicides involved ever. And as for fertilizer, perhaps an organic formula once every 5 years in the heaviest traffic areas, if that. Here's a quick review of my overall approach to managing a lawn organically. Always use a sharp mower blade. Tearing grass invites trouble. Dull blades can cause raggedy edges that invite discoloration or even provide entry for disease, and can also pull at grass plants rather than cleanly clip them. I bet most of us rarely check, sharpen, or replace blades. Do so now while we're talking about it. Don't cut too low. Though I lower the deck to about 3 inches for the season's final mowing, my normal height is 3.5 inches. I could probably cut at 3 inches if we have even summer moisture and it's not scorching hot. Then 2.5 inches at the season's finish. The most expert organic lawn care person I know cuts his mid-Atlantic lawn at 4 inches until the weather cools in October. Never let grass get so long that you cut off more than one-third of the height. In one cutting, if weather forces you to skip mowings, rake up and compost excess clippings rather than let them mat down. Otherwise, always let clippings lie to return nutrients to the lawn. With fall leaves, a reasonable amount can be ground up right in place, too, especially if your mower's a mulcher, but not as it deposits shredded leaves in mats. Rake and compost heavy accumulations. Don't feed if the grass is thick and green. A green, vigorous lawn doesn't need fertilizer, and all you're doing is causing yourself more mowing. If you think you need to feed next year, first do a soil test. Some high traffic or weak areas may need it, or at least a layer of compost, but probably not the entire lawn. Stop fertilizing as a reflex, no matter what marketers of lawn products say. Use only all natural organic products when you do feed. Never feed in winter or early spring. In New York State, where I garden, it has been unlawful since 2010 to fertilize in winter to protect fish and avoid conditions that favor algae bloom. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Please join us